Welcome to Behind the Lore, your backstage tour of the research it takes to make each episode of Lore Podcast. I'm Harry Marks, and today I'm sitting down with Jenna Rose Nethercott. We're exploring the research she did for Lore Legends Episode 7, Demon Lovers. Today, Jenna Rose and I are discussing modern interpretations of older myths, the portrayal of certain animals in folklore, and the people who marry the ghosts they love. Your support keeps us going, so once again, we're thrilled to have you behind the scenes with us. Please join us for a new episode of Behind the Lore. Hello and welcome to Behind the Lore. I'm here with Jenna Rose Nethercott, and we are talking about her episode, Demon Lovers. Hello, Jenna Rose.
Hello, Harry Marks.
How are you?
I'm feeling bonkers, but for all good reasons. Yeah, no, I'm going to have a wild energy radiating off me this episode, but I'm excited to say why, which is that there are secret new shows brewing at Grim and Mild. And so I've been in the studio all day scheming.
Ooh.
Scheming.
It's a good thing this is for our Patreon.
Pronouncing a lot of words in languages I don't speak. Eating cookies. Talking into a microphone. Brain turn into jelly. Let's go.
Living the life.
Living the life. Okay, tightening up. Demon Lovers. They're out there. Watch out.
So our first story is about Jorogumo, a spider-related tale. But one piece of it that didn't make it into the final episode was a related story about Arachne from Greek mythology. Can you walk us through it?
Yeah. So in the original outline, I had just tossed in the Greek myth of Arachne, which is where we get the word arachnid, meaning spider. And as the story goes, Arachne was a human woman who happened to be a very, very talented weaver. And she was so talented that she challenged Athena to a weaving competition, convinced that even though she was mortal, she thought she could outweave the goddess herself. And Athena accepted this challenge. But when the contest ended, Athena found that Arachne's weaving was better than hers. In fact, it was absolutely perfect. And she was pissed. So pissed that she beat Arachne with her own shuttle. And Arachne was so embarrassed by this that she ended up actually hanging herself and was transformed into a spider upon her death. So, yeah, according to Greek mythology, this is why spiders are weavers, is because they were human weavers first.
And this legend is one of the few about spiders that doesn't depict them as clever or tricksters. She probably thought she was being clever, but she ends up, becoming
humbled. It backfired
humbled.
In a big way. Yep.
It did. It backfired in a big way. She gets humbled big time. Did you discover, because in all the other stories we talked about, Native American, African, Caribbean folklore, spiders are depicted as tricksters or clever. Did you discover why that's the case in these other cultures and not in Greek mythology?
You know, I don't know why that's the case, but one of the interesting things that I did find when researching, like, the spider in Native American folklore, for example, is that, you know, these spiders that were these kind of anti-heroes pushing against social boundaries, in some stories, to, on the other hand, behaving in these violent, damaging ways as sort of a cautionary tale in other stories, ended up adapting once sort of white settlers, white invaders came to North America. And actually, the word for spider or the spider figure came to be assigned to the white settler figure as well. So the spider was sometimes a trickster and sometimes a villain, depending on how it was told. But yeah, I'm not sure why they were tricksters. Maybe because they're creepy little scurry guys.
And that,
you know,
that
a creepy
sort
little
of,
scurry guy.
Creepy little scurry guy. That has sort of lingered through generations of the idea of the spider as, you know, creepy or antisocial. I'm reminded of the spider in James and the Giant Peach, who is depicted as sort of standoffish.
Great.
Yeah, she's terrific. And she becomes a hero in the end, but she's very standoffish and, the only
something...
person.
Yeah, the only one who's got his back, really.
Exactly, yeah.
But I do think there's something primal in the way that we categorize spiders in our story, which is like humans are freaked out by spiders on like a visceral, primal, instinct-based level. Like, I am someone who's never been afraid of spiders. I think they're cool. I like spiders. And I remember I was at a friend's house and they had a pet tarantula. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's so cool. I've never petted tarantula. And I like reached into the cage to pet it and it twitched and my entire body just shut down.
Right.
Like I flung myself across the room and like that it was a fully involuntary reaction with no psychological like I had no problem with spiders. So I thought, but there was clearly something primal and survival based in like if a spider moves fast, get the hell out of there. And so I think that, yeah, it makes sense that spiders are often characterized as this kind of threatening troublemaker figure because our survival instincts consider them such.
Yeah, I put them in the same category as like snakes, you know, even though not all of them are venomous, enough of them are that you see one and your first instinct is, oh, my God, I need to get away from here. And what I find interesting about spiders is that they almost feel like glitches in the Matrix, like the way they move and the way they scurry and how fast they are. You see one it's uncanny.
It's super fast.
Yeah.
And you know, you see snakes categorized in the same way in folklore and mythology as these conniving, right, villainous figures.
Exactly. And I mean, that can be traced all the way back to the Bible.
Sure. And probably before.
And probably before. But moving out of the spider world and into the ocean world, we have the story of Sedna, who is a woman who creates all life in the ocean after being catfished by a bird spirit. This originated in Inuit culture. In your outline, you mentioned other versions of the story. Do you recall any of them that didn't make it into the script? And did they all come from Inuit culture?
Yeah, so as far as I understand, Sedna is an Inuit story, kind of across the board. And so when I talk about variants to this story, I don't mean like from other cultures as much as I mean like in some versions of the story, the bird is a loon. In other versions of the story, it's a raven, or, you know, it's
minor
these
details.
Small tweaks. Yeah, these minor details of how the story goes in the way that you see with any age-old folktale. But yeah, Sedna is specifically, she's a creation myth in Inuit culture. This is one of my favorite folktales in the world, actually. She starts life as this mortal girl who has these big dreams of travel and seeing the world. And then, yeah, like you said, gets catfished by a bird and ends up ultimately being killed by her own father, who thought he was coming to save her and then is a little bitch and gets too scared and decides to cut her hands off instead to save his own skin. And so she ends up actually becoming this vengeance goddess, essentially. She sinks into the sea. As her blood rises up in the water, it turns into all the sea life in the ocean, and she becomes the goddess of the sea and of the underworld. And so, yeah, I love the arc of her as this character. I love kind of the question of what would drive her father to go from being like, I'm going to rescue her, to actually, no, I'm going to sacrifice her to save myself. Like, that I think is a really strange, interesting characterization. And I also love her characterization starting as this naive but ambitious young woman and becoming this like vengeance goddess of the sea. And the idea too is that fishermen, if they're going to have a catch, it's because Sedna has allowed them to. So she ends up with an immense amount of power because she's been sacrificed. She's just great. She's just a great
she
time.
Is slay queen. There's a more modern interpretation of her story, which I was really fascinated by. Can you take us a little deeper into the interpretation by Hila Retzabi, who wrote an article for Prairie Schooner about the Sedna myth applied to the struggles we face today regarding climate change?
Yeah, so I think you're referring to this article that talks about how the exploitation of Sedna is a parallel to the exploitation of the Earth itself. She really represents, you know, she represents the ocean, she represents sea life, she represents the natural world. And the violence being wrought against her has this parallel in violence being wrought against nature. And, you know, in the same way I just mentioned, where if the Yeah, if the sea goddess Sedna decides to look favorably upon a fisherman, they can get a catch. The same goes for the opposite. So if you treat her poorly, you will be punished. If you, as a fisherman, are not kind to Sedna, not kind to the sea, not kind to nature, you will be punished by having a lack of resources come your way, which we can see so clearly in the way that climate change is playing out, right? Because we are not showing proper respect to nature, nature is beginning to fail to show proper respect to us, suffice to say. And the resources that we once would have been able to access, we are losing our privileges to because we're treating them poorly. We're exploiting them. But, you know, all that said, I think this is a story, like many folktales, that can basically be interpreted as a metaphor for whatever the hell you want it to be interpreted as. You know, I always sort of see this as a story, too, about, like, of course, the exploitation of women and violence against women. As well as, I think, you know, it served surely as a cautionary tale. The whole idea with Sedna is she is proposed to by a bunch of young men from her own village, but she decides none of them are good enough for her. So instead, she's going to marry this, like, opulent stranger, and it doesn't go her way. So, you know, this, of course, would be a cautionary tale to young women as well, to be like, look, don't run off with some stranger from another town. Stay here in your village. Marry someone local. You know, it was a story that would have been a warning to girls to keep them in line, also an origin story for how the sea life got into the ocean. And yeah, now it is able to be applied as a climate allegory as well. And this is, you know, one of the things we love about folklore, right, is that it can shift and change. And the story can stay the same, but what the story is saying can adapt to what needs to be said in any given era.
If only they'd had Netflix documentaries back then. She could have seen all the warning signs. He's promising you the world. He's going to take you all over the place. And in reality, he's a bird. And he's going to leave you in his nest and eat you.
Look, man, it's happened to everybody. We've all had Netflix warnings and people still end up accidentally with birds.
It's true. That's very true.
Birds are out there.
You did touch on something that leads into my next question. You know, these stories all so far have a running theme, women who eventually turn on the men who wrong them. What do we know about the originators of these stories? Were they prototypical incels just trying to keep women down, or were they stories mostly by women seeking empowerment over the oppressive male forces in their lives?
You know, I don't know who, we don't know who told them for the first time, you know, that's the deal with this kind of story. But my professional assumption would be that these were created as cautionary tales. This is my favorite category of folklore, actually, is specifically sexual allegories where they are warnings to keep people in line, sort of sexually in line. But instead of saying that directly, which would be far too crass and taboo, cultures come up with these fantastical, metaphorical, monstrous parallels in order to tell that story without telling it, right? So, you know, with the Yorogumo, you have this spider lady that this guy, that's basically trying to get this guy to, like, hold her baby. And whoops, surprise, the baby is spiders. And so it's like, you know, a warning against men from being like entrapped by beautiful women and stuck with a kid, right? Where they're like, yo, if you let yourself be seduced by this beautiful woman, you might get stuck with a kid. And guess what? Kids, they're not actually as nice as they seem. They might be spiders.
They might be spiders. Right? That was our worry.
Yeah, exactly. Did he come out as a spider?
No. He didn't. We had him checked.
Phew. Man, dodged a bullet, dude.
Seriously.
Sometimes they can come out as spiders.
Who knows? He still hasn't gone through puberty, so anything
can
happen.
That's true. We all run that risk in adolescence.
He hasn't molted yet.
God. But yeah, so, you know, and then Sedna, of course, like I said, is about warning girls not to run off with strangers. The Liananshi, which is also one of my favorite monsters from folklore, is, you know, also this kind of vampiric cautionary tale, though this one I think is a different metaphor than the just like warning men and women not to be too slutty, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of these, though, I think honestly just on a very basic level were that. They were like the Little Red Riding Hood narrative, where it's like, hey, don't run around and like sleep around or you might be in danger kind of directly. Yeah. But the Leanne and She is a whole different thing, and I love her. She is basically an explanation for why artists and writers die young. So, you know, like we talk about a lot here, folklore has different purposes. Some of those purposes are cautionary tales, like the ones we just mentioned. Some of those folk tales are explanations. And I think the Leanne and She is an explanation. An explanation for a phenomenon that was going on and just was so dire that it needed a metaphorical story to explain why these people were dying so young.
She's the Colin Robinson of legends.
It all comes back to what we do.
It always comes back to what we do in the shadows. What's interesting about all of these characters, though, is they're all considered life givers or caretakers in some capacity. They're, you know, Yorogumo is the mother with the child. Sedna is giving birth to all life in the ocean, and Leanne and She is this muse who sort of, at the same time as caring for this artist, sucks the life force out of him.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and you know, again, these, in a way, are just like the ones that I chose for this episode. There are tons of other demon lovers that fill different roles than that. These were just some of my personal favorites, but I do think that so often in these stories, women are metaphors, right? Where, I mean, and this is a kind of a problematic thing we see throughout history, is in storytelling, often in storytelling created by men, you know, men are people and women are like symbols. And so with these female characters, you definitely see them as these symbols. But that said, There are plenty of demon lovers that are not like mother figures. For example, one of my personal favorites is I just completely blanked on its name. Oh, the Ichyushka is the river version of it, or the Kelpie is the saltwater version of it. But that is a water horse, right? And this water horse can take the form of a very sexy man and will wander along the sea offering young maidens and young boys a chance to, quote, ride him. And so, you know, the problem being, if you agree to go on a ride on this pretty horsey, you will fuse to its skin, it will drag you into the sea and devour you, spitting your liver, lungs, and heart back on the shore. So, of course, this was a way for parents to be like, hey, daughters, don't ride the pretty horses. You know, it was like another sexual allegory. And, you know, those aren't caretaker mother characters, but it just wasn't one that we chucked into this particular episode. Yeah.
But you do have a type.
I do have a type.
The last story was actually one I really loved, because it's a very wholesome story, and it's about Bessie Brown, who marries the ghost of her dead fiancé. She lived at the turn of the 20th century. Surprisingly, this is not the first time this has happened, and probably won't be the last. There was, just a few years ago, a woman married a 300-year-old pirate ghost.
Teague!
Yep.
So I guess love Amanda Teague!
Dating's just really hard for some people these days,
Oh, my God. I could go on and on about Amanda Teague. So, yeah, I loved this story, too, actually, the Bessie one. I found it just, like, digging around for an epilogue for this. And I was like, oh, this story is so good and so sad. This girl who's just so heartbroken that her fiancé is killed, that she, like, marries his ghost and then, like, lives a life with him. Yeah. But Amanda Teague is a whole other situation. So Amanda Teague, for those of you who don't know, look her up. She is a contemporary Irish woman who a number of years back made a bunch of headlines for allegedly marrying the ghost of a 300-year-old pirate. Now, she also had commissioned a portrait of this pirate based on how she saw him, and it is literally just a painting of Johnny Depp as Captain Jack Sparrow. And it is so wild. She married this ghost on a boat, because apparently on international waters you're allowed to marry a ghost. All her friends came to this ghost wedding, but everyone got seasick, so everyone was, like, puking overboard as she was, like, marrying this ghost of Johnny Depp's Jack Sparrow. She goes into a lot of detail about her sex life with this ghost and would actually teach classes on how to have ghost sex, which I was, oh my God, Harry, I was so tempted to sign up. I can't even tell you. She would like,
man, Masterclass has, will let anybody teach.
I know. Dude, Masterclass will let anyone teach. Do you know that they have George W. Bush teaching diplomacy on Masterclass?
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Is that in between painting lessons?
Yeah, right? Psychotic. But anyway, yeah, Amanda Teague. So as the story continues, because it does, trust me, Amanda Teague, she sets up her best friend with another ghost, with another pirate ghost. So now she and her best friend are both dating pirate ghosts. Then Amanda Teague gets pregnant with a ghost baby. Oh my God, what a twist. So Amanda Teague, she's pregnant. She's waiting to give birth to this ghost baby. But then turns out 300-year-old ghost Johnny Depp is an abusive partner. And so she divorces his ass. And she's like, I'm done with this ghost. And I lost the baby. And then she decides that she's never dating a ghost again. And actually, she's an asexual. Which, okay. Just to close this out, I'm a little bit obsessed with the idea that maybe all asexual people are actually just erotically attracted to ghosts.
I mean,
just throwing that
possible.
Out there as a concept,
yeah,
for our listenership. Yeah, Amanda Teague, please Google her. She is a true national treasure of Ireland.
I love that not only does she claim that her pirate looks like Johnny Depp, but that he inspired Jack Sparrow.
That's
absolutely killer for
me. Yeah, that's how she explains the fact that they look so similar.
Yeah, that's funny. On the next installment of Days of Our Deaths.
Oh, my God.
So, on that note, thank you, Jenna Rose, for joining me today.
Thank you, Harry. I honestly, it is an honor and a privilege anytime I get to rant about Amanda Teague. So, glad to be here.
We're going to end up doing Lore Legends, you know, 20 years down the road, and she's going to be one.
Yes, I cannot wait until we've aged long enough to be able to do an Amanda Teague episode.
Yep. That's fantastic. All right, Jenna Rose, thank you.
Thank you, Harry. Bye, everyone.
Bye. And that does it for today's episode of Behind the Lore. A big thank you to Jenna Rose for spending time with me today. Did you know Lore and Lore Legends are part of a larger network of shows called Grim and Mild? And you can learn more about those shows and everything we do over at grimandmild.com. On behalf of the entire Lore team, thank you for your constant and generous support and for letting us tell you our stories. And until next time, thanks for listening.